fellow readers, and welcome back to Ravenclaw Readers with me, Claire.
And Ella.
And Paul.
Today, we are springboarding from Oliver Twist of last week and launching straight into another classic Dickens text, Great Expectations. Like most of Dickens' works, Great Expectations was originally published in a serialized format from 1860 to 1861. Great Expectations is characterized as a Bildungsroman, which is a brilliant term we English speakers have adopted from German, specifying a novel dealing with a personal and oftentimes spiritual development of a young person throughout their formative years. The protagonist of Great Expectations is Pip, who comes from a low working class background but harbours great ambitions to gain wealth and prestige in life. Owing to the fact that Pip is, you guessed it, an orphan, he is raised by his much older sister and her husband Joe, the blacksmith. When Pip is a young lad, he is brought to the home of the wealthy but extremely reclusive Miss Havisham to act as a playmate for Miss Havisham's adopted daughter, Estella. Pip soon becomes besotted with Estella, and though she treats him with cruelty and disdain, Pip resolves to become a well-to-do gentleman in order to win Estella's heart. This week we will be comparing Chapter 6, The Journey from Platform 9 and 3 Quarters, to Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, looking specifically at chapter 22. So Ella, would you like to provide us with a summary of the Harry Potter chapter before I launch into a summary of the Great Expectations one, please?
Yes, absolutely. So it's finally the 1st of September, and the Dursleys drive Harry to King's Cross, where Uncle Vernon gleefully observes that Platform 9 and 3 Quarters doesn't appear to exist. Luckily for a panicking Harry, the Weasleys arrive and take him under their wing, helping him to reach the platform just in time. As the Hogwarts Express pulls away from the station, Harry is joined in his compartment by Ron, and the two instantly become friends. A little while later, Neville, who is searching for his missing toad, also briefly joins them, as does Hermione. Towards the end of the journey, Draco Malfoy appears and offers to help Harry steer clear of the wrong sort of wizards, but Harry refuses, recognising Malfoy as the sort of wizard he wishes to avoid. Finally, the train arrives at Hogwarts Station, where the first year students are greeted by Hagrid and ushered into boats to cross the lake and arrive properly at Hogwarts.
So exciting. I'm so excited to finally be at Hogwarts. I was so looking forward to this chapter for such a long time. So I will give a brief summary of chapter 22 of Great Expectations. I've given a little background to the story of Great Expectations so far. So when we come to Pip in chapter 22, he is a young man who has been gifted a large fortune by a mysterious benefactor who he presumes to be Miss Havisham. In this chapter, Pip has arrived in London with his newfound money so that he may become a gentleman. Here he meets the good-natured Herbert Pocket, who is the son of Pip's tutor and with whom Pip shares a dinner. Herbert and Pip burst out laughing when they realise they have met each other once before. As children, they encountered one another at Miss Havisham's house, which resulted in a scuffle between the two. Neither hold any ill will towards the other, with Herbert helping school Pip in the ways of a London gentleman. Over dinner, Herbert tells Pip the tragic past of Miss Havisham, who was swindled by her lover, who abandoned her on her wedding day. Later, Pip is introduced to the rest of the Pocket family, to whom he instantly takes a great liking. And why I thought this would be a good text to read alongside Harry Potter is I figured this particular chapter from Great Expectations would work well with The Journey from Platform 9 and 3 Quarters, as it rolled over nicely from our discussion last week. In the previous chapter, we saw Harry get introduced to the wizarding world through the instruction of Draco Malfoy, and I thought it would be useful to parallel that encounter with how Harry is introduced to the magical world by Ron. Similar to Herbert Pocket, Ron is friendly and cordial, but also like Herbert, he is eager to prove himself. Harry and Pip both feel a bit out of their depth, but bonding with these prospective friends shows what a difference a bit of kindness and compassion can make.
The similarity between these two chapters is the role of Ron sort of inducting Harry into this new world, whilst Pocket inducting Pip. That's a direct sort of parallel, because here are two peers. You know, they're the same age. It's not like with Hagrid previously. This is someone who's, you know, in both instances, both Ron and Pocket are the same ages or thereabouts of our protagonist.
Yeah, because I think there is a big difference between being introduced into the society via Hagrid, who Harry doesn't mind kind of being a little bit embarrassed in front of or whatever. But when he was talking to Malfoy in the previous chapter in Madame Malkin's robe shop, he was, as you pointed out, Ella, he was saying he felt stupider by the minute talking to someone who was his peer. Whereas I think one of the distinctions between that interaction with Malfoy and the interaction with Ron is that it's clear that Ron, being a pureblood wizard and from this big wizarding family, has far more experience with the wizarding world. But Harry is less embarrassed about that. Like, there's one instance when Ron just says to him, "Oh, what Quidditch team do you like?" And Harry's like, "I don't really know any." And Ron's like, "Oh, you must be joking. It's great." And he launches into this big explanation of all like the different types of balls and where what all the players do. And it's not, you know, "Oh, you're so stupid for not knowing what Quidditch is." It's just Ron trying to share his passion for Quidditch with someone else. So it's a much kinder and friendlier introduction into the society. That's something that I noticed.
Yeah, it feels like a very safe space for Harry to admit that he doesn't know something. And I thought there was a really interesting parallel to how Herbert helps Pip understand, in the sense that Pip actually asks Herbert for help. And Herbert says in response, "I venture to prophesy that you'll want very few hints," indicating that Pip will pick things up as he goes along, and the fact that he wasn't born into this society won't necessarily be a hindrance to him, which is something Harry's very worried about and something that Ron is able to reassure him about. He says loads of people come from muggle households, they've never done magic before, and they get on just fine. As we'll see with Hermione.
Yeah, I think you're right, exactly. And we as readers can tell that Harry is going to be okay. I've always find myself every chapter pretty impressed with how Harry is kind of taking all this on the chin. Like, that was me. Like, when I was 11 and going into any, like, I remember going on school trips, because you'd go on a school trip every year in primary school at the end of the year, and I would get so nervous and so anxious about it and packing all my stuff and just getting so worried. And Harry's clearly apprehensive, but he's able to just take everything in his stride, and this is him entering a completely new world, and yet he's just doing so well. I think I'm just really proud of him at this moment, because I never faced anything like that, and I would still freak out about the smallest thing when I was a kid. So well done, Harry.
The kind of age-old idea of breaking bread with somebody is a really good way of bonding with somebody. And what we see here is Harry and Ron bond over all the chocolates and sweets that Harry buys on the Hogwarts Express, just as Pip and Herbert are bonding over their shared meal that they have.
The difference being, in Great Expectations, the meal reveals where Pip falls short. You know, it's an education. I mean, Ron exists to teach Harry and the reader about the magical world, but he also teaches you about Harry, particularly with later on with the interaction. Well, I mean, with the sharing of the food, mm-hmm. and also with the interaction with Draco.
The food they'd buy from the trolley witch.
Absolutely, yeah. And similarly, Herbert Pocket, and that interaction exists to tell the reader, or to tell Pip about Miss Havisham and society, but also to inform the reader of Pip's disposition and what kind of person he's like. And are they similar characters? Could you call Pip a hero in the way Harry Potter is a hero?
How do you read that? What is this interaction telling us about Harry, in your view?
So this interaction determines or that he's a Gryffindor.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Let me explain. So when Draco comes in and appeals to Harry to be his friend and to be a Slytherin almost, Harry, with full knowledge of, you know, not full knowledge, but he's slowly realizing what position the name Harry Potter, what Harry Potter means. Mm. He could easily go with the lads, but he doesn't. He sets aside his pride and stands beside Ron, and he chooses friendship over his own ambition or pride, which is what Slytherin embodies.
Okay, I think that's really, really interesting because obviously one of the things we're going to get into next week is this idea that the Sorting Hat says to Harry, you will do well in Slytherin. Do you remember this from the films?
No,
Okay, I just wanted to see how much you remembered.
but I remember you saying that.
Oh yeah.
And I think there is a real risk of him. You can see he's on the fence. I mean, he can speak that language to snakes,
Fossil tongue.
Parseltongue, and he does. There is an instinctual ambition there, but I think he's learnt to put that aside for friendship.
It's always made me curious to think why the Sorting Hat would have put Harry, why the Sorting Hat would have thought Harry would do well in Slytherin. And did the Sorting Hat make the right decision by not putting him in Slytherin? But I think that Paul has really picked up on something that's very true, and I'd never, because I was always so focused on that particular instance in the Sorting Hat chapter, I'd never thought about this previous interaction. So before Harry has even gotten to the Great Hall, I think Paul's right. I think he's shown that he belongs in Gryffindor and not Slytherin. And that's not any shade on Slytherin. I don't have a problem with Slytherin at all, but I just have never really thought Harry belongs in that house. So I find it kind of strange or somewhat intriguing when people say that he does. But I think Paul is right. Like he is ambitious, and as you say, he has begun to recognize that he could go places by just his name alone, and yet he decides not to take that offer. Because I was going to ask, is it like, do you think it was right for Harry to say not take Malfoy's hand when Malfoy offers his hand and is kind of saying, hey, look, partner with me, and Harry says, no, thank you, I can tell you the right sort of for myself. Do you think he did the right thing there? Because I think Paul is saying he did do the right thing. Well, what do you think, Ella?
Yeah, I would agree with that. So I think even for somebody who doesn't know anything about the wizarding world and the traits of the houses, we can just see that Malfoy is very clearly a bully in some senses. He believes that he's superior. He likes to denigrate other people, particularly the Weasleys, as we saw with the attitude towards Ron. So I think it was very good of Harry to instinctively recognize that hostile force in Malfoy and reject it in favor of Ron, who had just been nice to him, as had his whole family. So I think that was a good decision.
I was a bit unsure about whether or not Harry, I mean, obviously he overall makes the right call in not befriending Malfoy, but I was always thinking, oh, is it a little bit rude to say that, but to someone to say, oh, you're not, he throws what Malfoy says back in his face. And that, again, that always seemed a little bit rude to me. But you're right, Ella, like Malfoy is a bully, and he clearly has already teamed up with Crabbe and Goyle, who are latching on to Draco because of his name, which I kind of think does prove that Crabbe and Goyle belong in Slytherin. I've heard people say that, oh, they're not really cunning or ambitious or whatever, and okay, they're not necessarily clever, but I think they are ambitious because they spot Malfoy and they know to team up with this guy instantly, and Harry doesn't do that.
I think Draco sort of sees Harry's rightful position in Slytherin, that Harry, such a an someone who's achieved so much and done so much in such a short amount of time is surely to be in Slytherin. And I was thinking, Draco doesn't like, he doesn't like muggles, and I was trying to understand why. And the conclusion I came to was it's because muggles can't recognize his the you know mal his power or the power of his family, and then Harry Potter doesn't even recognize the power of his own name, and this Malfoy finds wrong and deeply unsettling that
So, do you mean muggles and muggle-borns? So, someone like Hermione coming in, she has no idea who Draco Malfoy is, she doesn't care. So, that's a problem to him.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that, but
Yeah.
absolutely, they don't know the name or what these old wizarding names
Pureblood
mean.
family.
And Harry at some point suspects that Weasley must be one of these old grand wizarding names.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Hermione might not be the best example because she's read all the books, so she would know from the books who these names are, but most Muggleborns would not have done all the background research that Hermione would have done. And even if you know from a book something, like she recognizes Harry's name from the book, for example, there's still a difference between reading it like that and growing up with the knowledge of these families like Ron does. So that's where Hermione and Ron's knowledge, sometimes they might know the same thing, but they know it in very different ways. And that's always there throughout all the series, is that we never quite get away from that.
I mean, I think that that's, again, another point of evidence which suggests that Harry, you know, should belong in Gryffindor rather than Slytherin, if wanting power and recognition is a very Slytherin-like trait. Harry just rejects all of that. He doesn't really want to be recognised for his name. He tries to shy away from that, and he finds it quite discomforting that people instantly know who he is. So he is sort of rejecting the power and recognition that the Malfoys crave.
And yeah, and Draco would be like, why? Why would you do that? That's what he, as you say, craves. And Harry has it, and he throws it away. For a Weasley.
Again, this is not to in any way denigrate Slytherin. But being ambitious and cunning are good traits, but they could lead to ruthlessness. And I think that that's where problems for Slytherin comes in. Because Paul, I remember you saying before you took the Pottermore test that you could imagine yourself being in Slytherin.
Yeah.
But then he got Ravenclaw.
I suppose, you know, the reason you could ask, you why would Hogwarts have a Slytherin school if all these things are bad? But as Claire says, these instincts which you have for ambition
can give you drive, and that can be a good
thing. Give you drive, but I think the a good education would help you sort of catch those instincts. Ooh. And there's a moment, you know, there are instances where ambition does give you drive, and you can become very successful. Maybe Dumbledore is a Slytherin, I don't know.
No. Do you not remember from this chapter? He's a Gryffindor.
Oh, he's a Gryffindor.
But he does have some very Slytherin traits.
Yeah,
so,
see what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, that's the benefit of having a Slytherin, is to teach these people that these instincts can be used for you.
Slytherin seem to be very out on their own, and they are a bit, they're not as included as the other houses are. And I'm wondering, is, as you say, it's like Hogwarts' responsibility to try and make sure that these traits don't get out of control in any house. I think that you could be excessive in the kind of major traits of any house, but the problem with Slytherin is that it can lead to just like ruthless looking for power, basically. Unchecked ambition, like Macbeth vaulting ambition. It's just something to think about, maybe for next week, particularly when we look at the sorting. Is it Hogwarts' fault as the whole institution that Slytherin is such a problem? Like, maybe the teachers and the administration aren't doing their job for these students to turn out well.
So I don't forget, I want to say this. I was reading some Hayek today, and it was saying how the these feelings of solidarity and, you know, boundness that one feels to their family makes sense in that social context. But if you were to approach larger society with the same feelings of solidarity, then you would destroy that society, which is the risk of Gryffindor, surely.
I think Slytherin gets a bad rep for having had, you know, all of the dark wizards happen to have been in Slytherin, and that's why we associate Slytherin with kind of darkness and evilness. Mm-hmm. But actually nowhere in the books is Slytherin ever specified as being evil, or even, you know, particularly dark. There's just the traits that Slytherins possess.
And
can,
the pure blood mentality.
Yeah, it can quite easily tip over into darkness, yes. But if you look at all of the songs that the Sorting Hat sings where it outlines, you know, Slytherin traits, they're never bad traits. They have the potential to become bad if, you know, if misused, but they're not bad in their own line of, like, essential being.
Yeah, I think these are all things that we can pick up on next week. And I'm especially interested as what Paul said about the dangers of Gryffindor, because as you've said, Ella, we are told time and time again throughout the books the dangers of Slytherin.
Here's a question for you all. What house would Pip belong to? There's a quote from one of my favourite Dickens scholars, G.K. Chesterton, which might help us here. So talking about Great Expectations, he writes, "It is the study in human weakness and the slow human surrender It describes how easily a free lad of fresh and decent instincts can be made to care more for rank and pride than for old affection and for honour. Chesterton argues that Great Expectations doesn't have a hero in the way other Dickens novels has a hero. So it is a novel which aims chiefly at showing that the hero is unheroic.
I think it's interesting, though, or kind of important, perhaps, to consider what he means by heroic. Because does he mean, you know, as I think we said in previous episodes, particularly the Homeric one, how hero is often kind of, you know, the warrior paragon type. Does Chesterton mean hero in that sense? Because if so, could change the way we interpret it.
Yeah, I think he means... so I think the sort of archetypical example that he gives is Hercules.
Yes,
the sort of demigod who overcomes and endures and accomplishes something. And here, Pip does not overcome, but in as he says, it's a study in human weakness. So the opening lines of David Copperfield is, who will the hero of this story be? Will it be me or will it be someone else? And as the pages unfold, you realize why the book is called David Copperfield, which is because the hero of the tale is that eponymous character. Equally, the name of Harry Potter and Sorcerer's Stone is Harry Potter.
And even now, it's still known as a Harry Potter franchise, even with like Fantastic Beasts. We still think of it as Harry Potter, even though he's not even in them anymore.
And Charles Dickens named a lot of books over the main characters, the heroes. But Great Expectations was not named thus.
Chesterton seems to suggest that, what was it, pride and... Pride. So rank and pride is not synonymous...
With affection.
With affection and honour. So those things are separate. So first of all, I would take issue with the argument that Pip doesn't overcome anything in Great Expectations, because I think he does.
Full disclaimer, I have not read Great Expectations.
Okay, well, it is probably my favourite Charles Dickens novel, and I think, Ella, is it your favourite too?
It is also mine,
yes.
But I will also say that I haven't read it for about 5 years, and I am slightly hazy on all the finer details. From what I remember, to get back to Paul's original question about which house would Pip belong in, I mean, not remembering the story fully means I can't make a fully qualified judgment on that, but I am leaning towards Hufflepuff.
I'm between Hufflepuff and Gryffindor.
Yeah, but if you think about Hufflepuff traits, it's kind of kindness, gentleness, and loyalty. And I think we see those traits in Pip as a child, even though he's enduring a lot of hardship. Mm-hmm. And then we see his commitment to Estella, even when, you know, she and Miss Havisham aren't the nicest of people. He still remains very loyal to his. I'm not sure if it's love or if it's a kind of devotion, but whatever it is, he stays very true to that.
Yes.
And I think these are very Hufflepuff traits.
I think, yeah, even in this chapter, they go to Westminster Abbey and
yeah.
He wonders of the horses and who shot them, and he thinks of his family. As someone who hasn't read the book, would you disagree then of Chesterton's reading that...
Yes.
That you would disagree that it's a study in human weakness?
It's a study in weakness, but Pip overcomes these weaknesses. So I think this segues nicely into I wanted to talk about the idea of greatness, Great Expectations. And Harry struggles with this too, because in the previous chapter, we talked a little bit about that idea, the distinction between great and terrible. And Harry says to Hagrid in the previous chapter, everyone expects great things of me and I don't know like how to live up to this, basically. So Harry is also struggling with this idea of what it means to be great. And Pip goes to London, he's got all this money and he has great expectations for himself because he's not happy just being with Jo, being a blacksmith. That's not what he wants. He wants to be a gentleman and he wants to have this money and show that he's great. And a lot of it is to do because he wants to show Estella that he's worthy. And I think that's coming from a bad place because it's coming from a place of infatuation, but and weakness. And yes, as Paul says, those are very Slytherin traits of Pip's, but he overcomes them in the end. I think that Pip is not heroic in the same way that Hercules is. And he has all these weaknesses. And part of his weakness is his ambition for greatness. But in the end, I argue that he overcomes these weaknesses. He overcomes his need for all this money and be a gentleman. He overcomes his infatuation with Estella. And it's only after he overcomes that infatuation can he truly be with her, and can he truly love her and she him. That's how I would see it.
I think, having not read the book, I think I will defer to your argument. Because
me over G.K. Chesterton?
I know, but I'll read the book and we'll do an addendum.
And I think as well, hearing you talk about it, because you do remember the book a lot better than I do, I now kind of want to maybe revise my judgment and just say perhaps we can't actually classify Pip into any of the houses, because he seems to possess traits from all of them
in quite equal measures.
So can we really put him in a single house when he's kind of a mashup of all four?
Mm. Equally though, is Harry the same? Harry is also a mashup of many different houses, because really we're all a mashup of all the houses. I mean, essentially that's kind of the point, but there still are traits that we tend to exhibit, or perhaps this is one that's very popular in the fan theories, and I think I agree with this. It's based on the traits that you value, and we all value these different traits.
Does Pip fulfill his great expectations?
I think he fulfills not the great expectations that he set out for, but I think the life that he ends up leading is superior to what he expected. Because it's more modest. And I would say the same of Herbert. So one of the things that Pip constantly says about Herbert is that Herbert has all the airs of someone who has made a great fortune. And Herbert fully, like Ron, he's going after this. He fully wants to make something of himself. And yet Pip can tell that Herbert's never going to be a man of much money. But what are Harry's? Does he have great expectations? I mean, I guess a lot of it is kind of just Harry getting caught up in what's going on. I think he's not really thinking straight. But he does, as the Sorting Hat will tell him, he has a thirst to prove himself. And I think that would be natural coming from where he is. But it's still his desire for greatness and Pip's desire for greatness come from different places. So for Pip, it's social and financial greatness. He wants to prove that he's above his station. And marry Estella, but Harry wants to prove himself, but he feels his greatness or the expectations of his greatness as a burden in a way, and maybe that's why he turns against Draco Malfoy, to go back to what we were talking there, because he's kind of, Pip is entering London society to try and prove his greatness, but Harry's come into the wizarding world already great, and that's a big burden to bear.
Yeah, I would say that the wizarding world has greater expectations for Harry than Harry has for himself.
Yeah, I think, what Harry achieves on this train ride is he makes a friend.
Aww.
He makes two friends.
He's so sweet. I love that.
And that's sort of what he expected to achieve by going to Hogwarts.
Yeah. He's never had a friend
Oh,
before.
I've got a really lovely quote, actually, which... So it's as the train is pulling away from the station, Harry actually thinks that he didn't know what he was going to, but it had to be better than what he was leaving behind.
It's like when you're a child and you're about to go back to school after the long summer. The summers in Ireland are remarkably long.
They're so long. They're,
like,
they're
3 months. And you would have this idea of walking back into the school. And in 3 months for a 14-year-old boy is a long time. You grow a lot. You have this idea of what the coming year is going to be. And in a way, it is a sort of great expectation. And it sounds silly to say it, but this is something I've experienced. You see, for Pip, Herbert is a means into fulfilling his expectation.
But Herbert is his friend.
In this chapter, it's a bit iffy, because of his past, and there's a judgment implicit in Pip's observations of Herbert, of him, that he will never be great, or that the pockets rather aren't so much grown up as tumbled up.
So you think that this is a snobbish judgment on Pip's part?
I think there is a snobbishness. Mm-hmm. He still has one foot at home in the old affections, thinking about old Joe and the horses, But he also, he meets this family who are better, but and he's nothing but critical of them.
You think he's critical? They're the family that...
By the river, yeah.
But they're... It's a family life that he never had. And I think you're right. There's definitely a more snobbish element on Pip's part looking at the Pocket family than there is on Harry's part, who doesn't have any of that judgment about the Weasleys whatsoever. But I still think that there are the seeds of Pip turning to this family and seeing the loving nature of that family. And that's what Harry sees in the Weasleys. Like Ella mentioned when Harry thought about, you know, the train pulling out of the station. And one thing I noticed is when you read that chapter, Harry looks back and he sees Mrs. Weasley waving and Ginny, and, you know, Ginny wants to go to Hogwarts. And it's almost like he's looking at his own family before, you know, he's even gotten really to know them. There's that attachment is there.
Mm. Well, I think Harry would be perfectly within his rights to kind of view himself already as a surrogate member of the Weasley family. You know, he's been adopted, essentially, right from the very beginning when Mrs. Weasley took him under her wing. And she, you know, she was the one who said, "Oh, you lost it. You need help getting onto the platforms. Okay, just you know, just follow my children. It's really easy." So, she, you know, she instantly comes over and she mothers him in a way that Harry's never had before, or at least he doesn't remember ever having had that before. So I think, you know, he probably already feels a kind of affinity with the Weasleys.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Harry is very, like, an act of kindness is very important to Harry because he doesn't have much of it at all. So when someone is kind to him, you're right, he picks up on that. And
even the twins teasing, he doesn't...
Oh, so sweet, though.
He doesn't mind it so much. No. Because when they're told not to, then they behave.
Yeah, and I love that Mrs. Weasley, like, the first thing, one of the first things she said when they say, "Oh, should we ask him about Voldemort?" Well, they don't say Voldemort, they say you know who. She says, Mrs. Weasley says, "Don't you dare. I mean, that poor boy has grown up without his parents. He's here all alone. Like, don't make him feel uncomfortable." And the funny thing is, Fred and George, I think that they take her advice on board, because they go into the compartment and they say, you know, Ron sits down and him and Harry don't really say anything to each other. And then Fred and George burst in and they talk about Lee Jordan's tarantula. And then they say to Harry, "Oh, like, this is our brother Ron." So really, Fred and George are being really good big brothers here and making sure that Ron gets a friend. And I don't think they want, like, maybe they do just kind of want to know the little bit of the story of, "Oh, I wonder what, you know who," or whatever. But they don't mention it and they don't bring it up. So they're just trying to have Ron make a friend with someone.
And what I also think is really interesting about what you just said about Mrs. Weasley telling her kids to give Harry some privacy, what she actually says, which is a direct quote from the book here, is, "The poor boy isn't something you goggle at in a zoo," which I thought, you know, it harkens right back to chapter 2 and the boa constrictor.
Oh, yeah.
I know, I noticed that too.
And I instantly thought, oh, wow, as, you know, as a parallel, my favourite word.
That is so sweet. I love Mrs. Weasley. All she sees is that it's this poor little boy who never had his mum and dad, and you just need to be kind to him and you need to be good to him.
I also want to talk about some other type of expectations, which is the Philosopher's Stone. And there's this mystery of the bank. There is this narrative energy which is pulling the train along to Hogwarts. We want to get to Hogwarts, but also there's this mystery, which is sort of the plot, I suppose, the titular Philosopher's Stone, which is starting to seep into the story, and we're starting to see that more.
It's like a single point that I want to make. Yeah. Herbert was telling Pip Miss Havisham's story, and he describes how she has just stayed in her wedding dress since the day she was jilted, how she stopped all the clocks in her house, how the, you know, there's, I don't know if this is actually mentioned in the book, about how just, you know, her wedding feast is just sort of going mouldy on the table and things like that. And she's basically stopped time from the moment when she was jilted. And it really put me in mind of Harry's house in Godric's Hollow, which is revealed to wizards who approach it. You see, like, the devastated shell of the cottage that they used to live in, and it's kind of held up as a shrine in the wizarding world to Lily and James and Harry and the sacrifices that they made. And it made me think that Miss Havisham's doing a similar sort of thing, but she's doing kind of reverse commemoration here. She's retaining a very, very kind of bad memory and constantly living that, and it's not supposed to be respectful. It's kind of like a way for her to hold on to her hate.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because oh my god, I don't want to talk about him until we get to a chapter, but when they mentioned Miss Havisham and the stopping of the clocks and being frozen in time, I thought about Snape. Yes, I think that there is that outward similarities of a place acting as a shrine to the past, but with Godric's Hollow, with the house there, it is, as you say, it's commemorative, and it's a place of communal mourning for many people. They come there, they write the little messages on the "Good luck, Harry," and there's even that statue dedicated to the family in the graveyard. Whereas Miss Havisham is locked away, all alone, isolated. So it's not commemorative. It's her just being paralyzed, as they say, frozen in time. And I feel like that's kind of what happened to Snape, is that he was frozen at this time after Lily's death, and he was never able to move on from it. So I feel like Snape's kind of a Miss Havisham figure.
That's a
He
really good observation.
lets it rule his whole life,
Yeah.
and he's just stuck there, and he can't mentally move beyond it. And yeah, we'll talk more like as this comes into the later books, but I feel like that's a really big problem with Snape.
Yeah, but I think what Snape is clinging to is his love for Lily, even though it might be quite a twisted love. That's what he's clinging to, whereas I feel like Miss Havisham is clinging to her hate, and that's what
See,
is fueling her
I
existence.
would argue that Snape's love is inherently bound up with bitterness and hate, because his love for Lily is always intertwined with his hate for James, and they're nearly always crumpled up together in his mind, like he can't get over. So his love is always bound up with something, with guilt of his own actions and with hatred. That's what
I think that is actually a very good point
I would.
that you've said, and I think J.K. Rowling kind of suddenly introduces the big reveal about how Snape has loved Lily all this time as a kind of redemptive feature, which almost tries to erase all of the awful things he's done to Harry throughout the previous six books. So actually, I can really see where you're coming
So
from.
I don't necessarily have an opinion that I've settled on in terms of Snape. So I kind of want to use this process as a way to untangle his character and try to see if I can come to some kind of conclusion about it. I don't think I'm ever going to say that he has completely redeemed himself and that he is blameless, because he's not.
You sense the importance of family here, that how we this the step to greatness is through we you know we you know people speak a lot of role models for children, and the importance of having a good family, and because it shows you the path to greatness. And for Ron, it's there. He can see, he knows what he has to do. He knows, the pressures. And it is a great pressure for him. It's anxiety inducing, but for Harry, it's an absolute mystery. And that's, I suppose, Pip's problem as well, is that he wants to be a gentleman, but he doesn't know how. And so he's looking for someone to auger him into this great society of being a gentleman.
Is the problem with Ron's effort for greatness, though, is that he says, even if you achieve these things, it doesn't matter because everyone else has already done it. So that's what Ron is struggling with. Yes, he knows what greatness is. And I love Mrs. Weasley, but she does have her faults, and one of those faults is she puts so much emphasis on, oh, you're a head boy, you're Quidditch captain, you're a prefect. And those are obviously great things to celebrate about your kids. But they are, this idea of having a rank and a social rank is very important to Mrs. Weasley. And I think that Ron feels that pressure on the one hand, but also has that difficulty of, like, how can I prove myself when everyone else has already done these things? So my greatness will mean nothing. And I think that's a really big thing to struggle with. And he's only 11, and he's kind of already recognizing all this.
Absolutely, it's like classic middle child syndrome.
Yeah, except a sixth son in a family of seven. Like, oh my God, poor Ron.
The feeling that Ron has that he's never good enough is actually a really crucial bonding point for him with Harry,
Yes.
in the sense that Ron is able to feel a kinship with Harry as soon as Harry tells him, "Oh, well, I never had as much money as I wanted when I was growing up. I had hand-me-downs from my cousin, and I was never number one, because Dudley was always held up as being, better and higher than I am." And I think Ron sort of really understood that, and that was how he was able to see something similar in Harry. Even though they'd had very, very different upbringings, that was a point in similarity.
Do you think that's the same with Pip and Pocket? Herbert.
Herbert says, please can we call each other by our first names?
Yes, Handel.
He gives Pip a little nickname
but
and everything.
He says, you know, as Ella, you pointed out earlier, he says, oh, you'll observe and you'll pick these up very quickly. And Herbert wants to make his riches. And his route for doing this is to sit in the counting house and look around, you know. But that's the thing is, said Herbert Pocket, that you look about you. That's the grand thing. You're in a counting house, you know, and you look about you.
Because Ron is looking for someone to usher him into the wizarding world. He's looking for recognition. He's looking to be a good Quidditch player. He's looking to be a prefect. He's looking to be head. We'll see all this in the Mirror of Erised chapter. Even though Ron was born into the wizarding world, just like Harry, he's still looking for some kind of validation of his station.
Do you think also that's one of the reasons their friendship took off so much is because Ron knows these things. Yeah. So in Harry's eyes, he's already great.
Someone we haven't mentioned a huge amount is Hermione. Because what are her expectations? She obviously also has these great expectations for herself. She's done all this reading. She knows who Harry is. Like, she probably knows more about Harry than he does himself, like, in a weird way.
She tells him that she's read all about him in about three different books.
And she, Harry, of course, can name every single book.
And Harry has no idea that he would even feature in wizarding books. What I think is really interesting about Hermione is that she is proof to Harry that you don't have to have been born into the wizarding world to achieve greatness in it. Because what we see from this chapter is she hasn't even started school yet, and Hermione is already really good at magic. Her spells work better than Ron's with his yellow or whatever it was.
That's not a real spell. We see spells, that's not a real one. Sorry, he's right.
You know, Ron's a pure blood wizard who's been born into the wizarding world, and yet the examples of magic that we see from Hermione are better than what we see from Ron. So Harry, I think, can really take heart from that.
I think that's a good point.
Being from a muggle background won't hinder him at all.
I agree, but... And I love Hermione. She's a very special place in my heart. But she is so obnoxious here.
She is incredibly obnoxious.
She is. And I think a lot of it comes from a place of deep insecurity. I mean, and Hermione, she works on this. You know, she does throughout the books. But what does she say? Hang on, I'm going to try and find this.
I'm the smartest wizard on this train, said
Hermione. Okay, see, she doesn't come in with that. Like, she's not that self-important. Like, Draco would come in with that attitude. Mm-hmm. She comes in with, I know things because I've read about them.
Yeah.
But she says here, okay, so this is basically the first thing they see Hermione, and she's asking about poor Neville has lost his toad. And Hermione comes in and says, has anyone seen a toad? She's making fun of Ron a little bit. She teases him a bit, saying, are you sure that's a real spell? Said the girl. Well, it's not very good, is it? I've tried a few simple spells just for practice, and it's all worked for me. Nobody in my family's magic at all. It was ever such a surprise when I got my letter, but I was ever so pleased, of course. I mean, it's the very best school of witchcraft there is, I've heard. I've learned all our set books off by heart, of course. I just hope it will be enough. I'm Hermione Granger, by the way. Who are you? And it's like, you know, all these like, oh, it's the very best, and of course this, and of course that. And these really indicate to me that this poor girl, she's being terribly obnoxious, and in a way is trying to show off, but that showing off is coming from a place of deep insecurity because she's so worried she's not going to fit in.
And she very obviously has great expectations for herself on that.
And
she wants to succeed and do well. Yeah.
You know, because he's worried of falling short, that he, you know...
The way I see it is that Ron feels that he needs to prove that he is as good as his brothers. And Hermione needs to prove that she belongs in the wizarding world as a muggle-born.
Yeah, I think so.
So what does Harry have to prove? Because Harry already knows nothing about the wizarding world, but belongs there.
Maybe Harry has to prove that everybody's belief in him isn't misplaced. Maybe he kind of has to live up to his great name in a way, which is a terrible burden to force onto a young child.
Yeah, I know. I just realised that, like, all these children, including Malfoy, coming in with these great expectations, a lot of them coming from their family or their history of, or of course in Hermione's case, her lack of history in the magic world. And Malfoy already has all these expectations of, you know, I'm going to be in Slytherin. I'll see if I can get a broom. You know, he has, and clearly he's had this pressure put on him as well. And it's coming from a different place. But I think all these children are actually, they're all actually quite scared coming to Hogwarts. And I think that that kind of shows the way that they enact this apprehension speaks a lot to the type of characters that they are. But to be fair to Ron and Harry here, if I were them, I don't think I'd want to be friends with Hermione in this instance. If I were Harry, she would make me feel worse.
Yeah, you definitely don't see the instant affinity and connection of friendship with Hermione that you see Harry have with Ron.
But I like that because it shows that friendship can come from different places and they can start off differently. But you could, it's still, just because you don't have that instant connection with someone doesn't mean that friendship can't grow.
So exactly. I think that that's it's actually not any kind of, less valid or true.
No, exactly. And of course Hermione is like invaluable to the trio. So I think that that's actually kind of a nice place to start with Hermione, even though it's not nice for poor Hermione, who ends up getting a bit upset later on.
I suppose it teaches that his friendship with Hermione teaches him something, which at the moment all his friendships are based on acts of kindness. Mm. I don't know exactly how they become friends, but here's this character whose his first interaction with her isn't like that of with the Weasleys or with Hagrid lighting the fire and giving him sausages or whatever. But I suppose it teaches him not to be so quick on judging people.
Yes.
I think in a way really does relate back to Pip, because the whole reason that Magwitch becomes Pip's benefactor is because of an act of kindness that Pip has.
Convict.
Yeah, it's an act of kindness that Pip has done for him, and that Pip didn't necessarily interpret it that way himself, because he was terrified and he felt like he was being coerced by this awful criminal into helping him, you know, get the files, whatever it was he needed to free himself. But Magwitch saw that as a deep act of kindness, because nobody else would have done that for him, nobody else would give him the time of day. And that act of kindness from Pip, which seemed insignificant to Pip himself, had huge repercussions and helped Pip to become great.
I think Hermione's kindness does show in this chapter, in that she's trying to help Neville find his toad. And that's really nice. So she does have a kindness and she does have a kind soul. And that's very clear. Like, that's the first thing she says. And then she sees Ron trying to perform the spell and gets very insecure, and then just goes to her default, oh, I've read all these books and look, I do belong here.
So there's one thing I know future on the books that has changes my reading of this scene, which is that Scabbers is not what he seems. He is a 35-year-old man sitting in this train carriage who bit a child's hand. Poor Ron. You can't even get a pet. It's a 35-year-old man. Imagine how bad he feels. Here's Scabbers, and here's looking at Ron, wave this wand in front of him, saying, "You fat rat, turn yellow."
Peter Pettigrew is only a fat rat out of cowardice. Okay, so he's not getting my sympathy.
And he probably has such low self-esteem anyway that he doesn't even register these insults anymore.
Oh, dang, Ella.
Savage.
That is very savage.
Throwing all the shade over here.
I am shocked and impressed. The only thing I would say about Scabbers is I think probably Rowling didn't have everything planned out. So I don't know if there's actually any foreshadowing in this chapter, but the way that I
really mucked it up with Scabbers.
The reason that I would think that this actually speaks to Peter Pettigrew's character is he doesn't care what's going on around him. He's like half asleep, whatever. And the instant someone comes to attack him, I don't think he does it out of any sense of nobleness or anything to try and defend Ron and Harry. I think it's purely self-preservation. This is what Peter Pettigrew does. He's like, oh, what's this hand? It's coming towards me. I'm going to just bite it and protect myself. I don't think he cares about anyone else. That's all I'll say. It's just self-preservation.
No Tom, Dick, or Harry.
Exactly. The last thing that I wanted to talk about, it doesn't parallel to Great Expectations, but I was wondering, why is it that the first years cross the lake? Because it's only the first years that do it. Every other time they get pulled to the castle by Thestrals, and of course Harry misses it like half the time as well. But why? What would the significance of that lake crossing be? Paul, I asked you this and you said something to me.
A bit of hazing.
Yeah, he was a bit of hazing.
No, what was my point?
You were like, well, it's just practical.
I mean...
You talked about the practicality of it.
Well, the first thing I mentioned is such a powerful image. What's more of a spectacle? Invisible horses or these boats gliding like marbles on glass over this dark lake towards this castle? So it has... It's such a memorable image.
Mm.
And then I was thinking, maybe it's just, I mean...
Practical to get the practical. First years there after the rest of the
Your first day in secondary school, all the first years are grouped together and inaugurated. And this is part of their inauguration.
Well, because they do all have to get sorted. So the rest of the class, the rest of the school has to be there before them anyway.
Yeah. Maybe it's a symbolic, as you said, a symbolic sort of gesture of... Maybe this is how certain people entered the castle previously. Mm-hmm. And so it's a crossing a threshold kind of moment.
Kind of reminds me a bit of Dante's Inferno, when all the souls who are crossing over, they have to get the ferry to their new home.
The river Styx.
Yes, they have to cross the river. But they have to have the ferryman, who is Hagrid.
Who is Hagrid.
And they have to cross the river before they can get to the next stage of the afterlife, I suppose.
I suppose is what, you know, this is the second time Harry has travelled in a boat. The first one was escaping Hogwarts, and this is turning and embracing it.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that. That's an interesting mirror image.
And the stormy night versus the tranquil evening.
The still tranquilness. Yes, I initially thought of it in the same way that Ella's talking about, because water it's a transition space, right? So you're coming and you're going. So it's inviting these children to Hogwarts to pass this threshold, just like the River Styx is moving from the land of the living to the land of the dead. And it's moving these children into their new land. And it's like saying to them, it doesn't matter if you're pure blood or muggle-born or whatever it might be. It doesn't matter what your background is. You're transitioning into your new home, and this is Hogwarts, and it will welcome you. And because the image of water also reminds me, the thing that I think of is a baptism. So it's being baptized into your new community, and all these people are together, and they are all equal in this world. Those are grand ideas that, you know, a lot of individuals in the wizarding world don't always live up to, but I think that is the message that has been trying to get across. Oh yeah, we want to end with we have these little chocolate frogs, little Harry Potter chocolate frogs. So we're going to give it to Paul. The thing that I wanted to do is I wanted to guess what wizarding card he was going to get.
It's surely too cliche to say Dumbledore.
Do you want to go
but
with Dumbledore?
I don't know who else it could be.
We had someone at work guess Helga Hufflepuff. I thought that was a good guess.
That is a good guess. Mm.
My guess is Ravenclaw. That
Rowena Ravenclaw.
Rowena Ravenclaw.
I'm going to go with a bit of left of field one. Merlin. I don't know.
Well, if you think about when they opened their chocolate frogs, we had Cersei.
Yeah, I know.
We had
that.
Merlin. We had Morgana.
Yeah.
We had Paracelsus, I think.
Yeah,
we had
really
all sorts
ones.
Of alchemists and magicians. Yeah. So really, it could be any of the named, any of the
Hopefully
above.
We'll get Peristalsis.
Okay, let's open it up, everybody.
Godric Gryffindor.
Oh! It's Gryffindor! Dang!
And you named Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff and didn't spiral around to Gryffindor.
Oh, this is a small frog.
It's actually very... The fact that it's Godric Gryffindor is really appropriate. I love that.
Would you like to just read the description of Godric Gryffindor on the back of the card?
Yes. Okay.
Godric Gryffindor, TM. One of the four founders of Hogwarts, TM. Godric Gryffindor, one of the four famous founders of Hogwarts, school of witchcraft and wizardry. Godric Gryffindor was the most accomplished dueler of his time, an enlightened fighter and against muggle discrimination, and the first owner of the celebrated sorting hat.
Thank you so much for listening. Next week we will be looking at Chapter 7, The Sorting Hat. And we will be reading that in parallel with The Crowning of Arthur from Sir Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur. If you want to send us a message or follow us on Instagram, we're at Ravenclaw Readers. And if you want to have a look at any of the show notes or get a bit more behind the podcast, we are at ravenclawreaders.com. So please come and check us out there. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Thank you.
I can't remember what the Philosopher's Stone is. Something to do with the phoenix down in the basement.